Space Watchers. This is Space Cafe Radio. A new Space Watch channel about trends, people and conferences. When our Space Watch team is on the road, we will talk with people and we will let you know all about the cool stuff they told us. Welcome again. In this first episode, I had the chance to go to Bulgaria, to Sofia, and to the Rhodes Mountain to meet with Endurosat CEO Raito Raichev and his wonderful team. I had also the chance to meet 16 absolute super talented young people that formed the 2021 cohort of the Space Challengers.
Raito, what is your dream?
I think what I mostly would like to see is space made truly accessible and truly decentralized. And I would ideally like to see hundreds of new innovators in the final frontier. And if we can help a little bit with what we are doing on a daily basis, I'll be quite happy.
What is your background? What brought you to space?
I've never had aha moment where I woke up one day and I realized or I watched a movie or something inspired me. Probably it was some event in my childhood, but I don't remember it anyway. So my memory is quite loose at the times. I've always wanted to build spacecrafts and I've always been fascinated about space. I've read a huge amount of science fiction when I was little. So all the standard stuff. Then I went and studied history because I really wanted to understand what's going on and why we are developing in certain ways the civilization in a very wrong direction. And then I was even more convinced that we need to build something in space to as a plan B. So this was more or less the journey. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to get a full scholarship and to go to International Space University years after I graduated history. And this is how my space journey began.
Sounds good. And how do you think to put your dream into reality?
Step by step, I would say. Our belief of the core group of Endurosat, actually also part of the founders, members of the educational program Space Challenges, which I'm really proud that despite all the difficulties, we put a tremendous amount of effort and for 11 straight years, we keep developing the educational program. And the vision has not changed at all. So we fundamentally believe that universal access to space would improve human life condition on Earth. So if you think about it, even philosophically, we started with education because what's better way to inspire people who are much smarter than myself? For example, here in the audience, I'm pretty sure that in 5-10 years, we'll be surprised how many new incredible ideas would drive to space and they'll look at us and say, look at these old people with their very obsolete ideas while they're changing the future. So education is a vital component. And then afterwards, we realized, well, we could actually try to go further and to really try to make space accessible even further, not only by providing knowledge, but also to expand it to a vision where we eliminate the complexity of what it means actually to get to space, to get to orbit, to operate your sensor and payload. And this is how Endurosat got born in 2015 in a small attic apartment, 25 square meters. We started with 5 engineers and actually all of them came from Space Challenges, which is a good statistic to have. And nowadays we are 92 and more than 40 people in the team came also from Space Challenges every year. We find like-minded lunatics to join the journey. It has been a wild ride ever since.
I just had my age moment a few minutes ago when we were talking about Star Trek and Star Wars, what inspired us. And answer was, what is Star Trek?
Oh, and you guys.
I was shocked and I felt so old. Yeah.
Which is a good reminder that we should file also an exam later next week for the students based on episodes from Star Trek. Don't worry. Point taken.
So founding the company is one thing, but how did you grow it? Did you get government funds? How did it work?
Not at all. Actually, for 11 years running the educational program first as a non-profit, we've never ever used governmental funding for the entire program, which I'm really proud of. And then later, of course, with Endurosat, we didn't use any governmental funding. I believe in the core entrepreneurship values where you try to create better value or an existing solution to the market that makes the world a little bit better. So technically, if you think about entrepreneurship, we had a talk with a few of the students. I like this terminology that entrepreneurship is the relentless pursuit of opportunity, disregarding the currently available resources. And so this is what we basically try to do with Endursat. We started with an attic apartment, 5 people, and trying to explain to the rest of the surrounding. We are going to change the satellite industry. Don't worry, it's going to happen. We are doing it. It's inevitable. And things started moving at some point. But it was painfully slow and painfully...
At one moment of time, you need money. How did you kick that off then? And where did the money come from?
The thing is that by the time that I founded the company, I didn't have any savings. So first, because I'm not a very pragmatic person, as you can imagine. Usually people wake up in the morning and they want to do something reasonable and find a proper job. I wanted to build a space program. So apparently I didn't have any money in the process. I took a bank loan, actually, at the beginning, a very small one that could have given us 3 to 4 months of air in the company to start building the systems. Majority of my friends and colleagues that are all together that we started the company are nowadays co-founders and they are all in the company since day one. And the interesting part was that the first few months we literally worked bootstrapping the thing, worked almost for free. We could barely afford even our desks. So we bought an IKEA big tables, 2 of them. We were very proud. And this is how we started. And in the process, I started pitching the idea. And I definitely learned 2 things. First, I'm tremendously bad in pitching. So I talked with more than 20 different investors. And at certain point, I considered it successful conversation if the guy didn't call the security guards to walk me out. Because you can imagine in Eastern Europe, someone entering into someone's office and say, hey, I'm Raichu and I'm in space program. I think you should invest it. And definitely it's a good deal for you. And then suddenly a security guard comes up out of somewhere and just walks me silently out of the office. I learned the hard way that we have to improve and articulate the message. And at certain point, we were almost running out of money when I met our first angel investors. And happily, those were really, really successful software entrepreneurs in Bulgaria. And interestingly enough, we met during an educational gala dinner. And the first thing that my partner said at the time was, if I didn't work on software, I definitely would, my dream is to do something in space. And I was like, we literally didn't know each other. And this was his first talk, his cool. First word.
Yeah.
We clicked and literally the next day, these guys actually... transferred money capital in the company without us having even a contract and we signed a deal later. So it was really incredible to see this gentleman behavior at the beginning. And then 2 other angel investors came on board, friends of theirs. And this is how it took off the ground. Yeah. The first years were the hardest one, by the way, because many times we were literally few weeks out of closing the shop because we had to an enormous learning curve in front of us. Nobody taught us how to do stuff. Then we had to really push ourselves on a daily basis. There were no Saturday, Sundays. At the point we got to the situation where one of our engineers tells me, hey, do you know that today is Easter? Let's find eggs and celebrate. Something. Literally, we were pushing it to the extreme. We had a couch. We were sleeping in the office many times. It was fun nights. But it's also ungrateful because making a startup work is hard. Making a space startup work is excruciatingly painfully hard. I always tell the story that it's having a space startup is like being a baby again. You wake up at 5 a.m. and you just cry. So basically, this is what happened. We knew that we need to learn from the market. We started talking with a lot of people. We already had really clear vision what and how we want to do it, what type of technology we want to develop. And we are pushing in the first 3 years were the hardest. In the moment that we got on the market, suddenly things started moving much more dynamically. I was skeptical that the market would accept a small startup because usually market is full with a lot of hype and a lot of overpromising. But the first customers came pretty quick. And in the first year that we went on the market, actually, it was that at the end we were already profitable, which was also very rare situation, it seems, in the space. And ever since we grow, trying to be very aggressive in our implementation of the vision, but also careful with the finite resources that we have in the company.
The first million is always the hardest one.
Yeah. The first million, actually, you never notice it. That's the other thing. Because you never sit in front of the bank account and accounting call. I don't know. It's like a deal number 5. And now I'm making
right.
The first million.
Bulgaria is not known as a big space nation, to say it at least diplomatically. Bulgaria, in my understanding, does not have a space law. Even so, on the 27th of January 1967, Bulgaria signed the Outer Space Treaty, and it's also ratified. And it also signed the Registration Convention. Interesting enough that there's no spacecraft, even not yours, is officially registered at the United Nations. But how did you get an approval for launching a satellite, making Bulgaria a spacefaring nation?
Here, a few misconceptions. First, Bulgaria had actually a very strong space program. We had two cosmonauts in space, although we are a very small country. We've launched a satellite with at the time in partnership with the Soviet Union. And the satellite was pretty big, by the way. It was, I think, more than a few hundred kilograms and worked flawlessly for many years. In Bulgaria, one of the institutes of space research and the other of, I think, biology or biomedicine, they created one of the first types of processes to conserve the vitamin properties of the food for astronauts. So all the astronauts in the Soviet era and in Mir space station, majority were using food produced in Bulgaria. So actually Bulgaria, it's not very good in outreaching the achievements in the years, in the decades before we came to the market. But after the change, the space education is almost non-existing in the country today, which is a very bad thing for us. And that's why we initiated this space challenges effort. And secondly, we believe that we are already quite significantly contributing to the new space ecosystem. And we are a purely Bulgarian company, although we're really proud that we have more than 10 nationalities in the team. And we want to keep expanding it as an international effort. So in that regard, I think there is a significant role that Bulgaria could play, as long as these guys in the auditorium and people like them push themselves a little bit harder and do some meaningful work, I think we'll be on a very proper start. And the last few years, Bulgaria is also starting the integration process with European Space Agency. We have worked successfully also as a company, as an organization with the European Space Agency in the last few years. A lot more work should be done on national level, I believe, because, for example, one of the deficiencies is that we still don't have space agency. Yeah. Which would be relatively easy to organize, and this could become a hub of knowledge and excitement and outreach towards space in the country. The other thing is that the process of integration of Bulgaria at ESA currently is not the fastest one. But from the other side, there is a light in the tunnel always.
Okay. That did not answer the question, how do you get the approval for launching your satellite?
We have registered all our satellites into the proper listings of satellites. First, how you do launch satellite, that's a good question. You have to have a space flight qualification mandatory. In our case, we do that at one of the biggest laboratories working with European Space Agency directly. Then you have to register frequencies, both for emitting signals for space to ground and ground to space. In our case, we apply to the local administration, which is part of the Ministry of Transportation and Communication. In ITU and actually the ministry, of course, because that's the usual procedure, the ministry applies in ITU, which is the International Telecommunication Union, where we get a registration and filing for all our missions. Actually, you cannot go to the launch pad and launch your system in space if it's not already registered and accepted by ITU standards. And then, of course, we sign a contract with the rocket launch provider, and there is the export-import, and then many months later, you are actually in space. So that's one of the things that we try to really hard optimize with Endurosat for our customers. The people really don't understand the logistic burdens of trying to launch even a small nanosatellite in space. It's excruciatingly slow and demanding legal processes involved. And if we can create a service where those processes are taken care of for our customers, we are saving them a ton of complexity and a ton of lost time in the process. So that's one of the newest things that we are trying to do in Endurosat.
Tell me, for Endurosat 1, or your satellite in space, you have used the amateur frequencies?
Yes. Yeah.
And even that has to be filed by the ITU?
Yes. We had two filings. One is with IARO, and actually we're really proud because the whole satellite was built entirely by Endurosat team, of course, because it's a CubeSat and it was complex for us and it was our first intent to space. Mm-hmm. But the satellite mission was purely radio amateur, so we opened the frequencies to radio amateurs all around the globe, so hundreds of people were getting packages, data from our satellite, and the operators of the satellite were actually, again, part of the students of Space Challenges program. And quite significant part of those students afterwards joined the Endurosat effort. So it was first, it's very rare that a space company would literally donate an entire satellite for an amateur educational mission. We did that full consciously. Mm-hmm. Of course, the engineering team, Endurosat, was supporting the effort, but literally the entire operations, the entire sequences were done primarily by students of Space Challenges. One of those students actually is our current CTO in the company. So okay. You can imagine that there was a ladder of evolution in our practice education program. And in the company.
Let's talk about your company, Endurosat. So what is your product? What is your service? What are you bringing to the market?
We design and build nanosatellites. And lately we offer a shared satellite service where we could easily get your payload to low Earth orbit and enable you to operate your payload at your own discretion directly using digitalized mission control in the cloud. So in a nutshell, what we are trying to do is help you focus on what matters to you as a company, as a commercial player, 95% of the space companies are actually data companies, but they still waste enormous amount of resource and time trying to build their own spacecraft, trying to go through the licensing procedures. And sadly, by the time that they actually go and operate their sensors in space, usually 3 to 5 years have passed. And this is an enormous amount of time for businesses on the ground, which you're supposed to be your customers. Yeah. So by the time that you can actually generate meaningful data and analyze it and go to the customer, probably a lot of the expectations and requirements of these customers changed, and you're left with a really nice asset in space, but really difficult data type to commercialize in the way that you were foreseeing. When we analyzed that, we thought, what do we need to do so that we can get those sensors in orbit much faster, eliminating the entire complexity for our customers? So that first we could literally lower significantly the financial and the timing barriers, but also eliminating the complexity of the satellite supply chain for our customers. This has, in our opinion, two major benefits. One is our customers are still space operators and space owners, and they have the self-esteem of becoming the next generation of innovators in space. But more than that, they are focusing 90% of their efforts and time and resource into their sensors and refinement of their sensors and into their data and commercialization of data, instead of losing time into the traditionally, okay, let's reinvent the wheel, let's build our own satellite. And the way that we approach it from technology point of view also is interesting. We tried to make our satellites as flexible as possible on avionics level so that we can handle any type of payload that could be fitted in a nanosatellite without the necessity to modify the hardware of the satellite, because we really wanted to get out of this game where single satellite, single mission type of mindset leads to you tailor making satellite for a specific mission, which also is time consuming and of course very expensive. And we wanted to try out a new approach. Of course, this is not an original idea from a point of view that a lot of industry players were trying to do it for a long time. But we actually managed to do it, I believe, properly, because we started our engineering of all the systems of nanosatellites that we do today from scratch with this mindset in mind. And early on, we risked trying to make everything software defined by nature, which means in a nutshell, hardware of the satellite dramatically changed the performance to accommodate the requirements of the payload without you having to modify it on a hardware level, just with the simple software commands. And this leads to other extras, like you can upgrade the system over the entire mission lifecycle, one. And secondly, you can run in the very near future that you can actually run applications directly on the satellite as well. This, I think, would open a whole new area of opportunities for our customers and partners.
Who are your customers? What kind of customers are those?
I'm happy to share that we have more than 120 customers in otherwise very conservative industries. Majority of our customers are commercial space companies, especially new space companies planning their own unique single missions or even constellation programs from one side. From the other side, we work with a lot of space agencies. By working with space agencies, they actually work with us procuring systems and technologies from Endurosat. And then we have also the part of about 25% of our customers are universities from all around the planet. We're excessively happy to work with, because those are the bright minds of the future. And they do actually an incredible type of programs. They learn very fast. And what I like a lot about them is that all those universities have fantastic groups of young people who I think would surpass us inevitably in the next 5 to 10 years with their own efforts in space. And our logic is, could Endurosat serve as the simple infrastructure builder on a lower cost and lower orbit missions, where we enable and empower you to do your proper science, to focus all your efforts on your science, on your own commercialization of data, which in our case is remote sensing, Earth observation and IoT, those three precise applications, and lately also meteorology. And then, of course, technology proof of concept lately. With our platform, we are enabling a lot of customers to go really fast in space and test their prototypes of new technologies. Because I think one of the biggest deficiencies of new space industry is there is not so many options to try out your space technology in a proper environment, and the sooner the better. That's our logic.
What is unique? You are not the first one building CubeSats. You are not the only one offering entire missions. So what is unique?
A few things. I think a lot of customers appreciated the difference in our approach towards the satellite subsystems, because they're more flexible. You can easily integrate them in your own spacecraft if you're talking about the hardware. Secondly, the software-defined nature of the spacecraft, the entire platform, actually gives you opportunity to fly completely different sensors together in a single mission. And that's, I think, one of the benefits, because there were before us and there still are quite fantastic missions in using nanosatellites to fly different payloads. But the time that it takes them to modify the satellite and again to tailor-made a specific satellite to carry specific payloads, it's much less streamlined than what we managed to do with our software-defined platform. This means that the customer knows exactly how much the mission would cost you on a business level. We were the first to announce the pricings of all our systems in the website. We really believe in this gentleman behavior where you can literally go online, configure your satellite in 5 minutes, and you know how much the modules cost, and you can literally buy them in a very streamlined way. Just to give an example, usually in the more traditional nanosatellite industry, even this costs a tremendous amount of exchange of NDAs, and then we give you a tailor-made price for a module that should be relatively a commodity, and we try to commoditize everything. We said, no, you enter online, you see how much it costs, you see how much this system could do for you, of course. You can talk to us immediately, and the responsiveness and the clarity and the openness of our business, I believe, is one of the reasons why people start working with us. We always are really proud of Endursa that no hidden fees, no complexities. Whatever you receive, that's it. In terms of missions, you're right, there is movement towards offering satellite as a service or space as a service or shared space as a service or shared orbit to service. But what we do differently, I believe, is first the timing that we offer you and the pricing that we can offer, because we are full stack satellite company building every single part of the system in-house. Mm-hmm. It's a tremendous advantage in terms of the cost that the customer would take. It's literally an order of magnitude lower than the traditional space industry. And at the same time, it is the fact that you pay for our shared satellite service for the data that you get from space. So it's literally similar to the model that the mobile operators have, where you can literally for the first time control the cost. It's not a cost plus type of contract, very usual for the space industry, but it's a fixed contract, much more closer to the way that we all pay our mobile phones. You know that for this year, I will pay X amount of money for receiving my data. You can stop the service if there is some discrepancy into the quality of the service. So I think this is really generously opening opportunities for small startups, but also for constellations, because imagine that this will be the first time that a constellation could really control the cost per year of all your space assets, all your sensors. And I think this is, we haven't seen it in the industry before us, and hopefully we can demonstrate that this model works really well.
Can you elaborate a bit more about this software-defined satellite? How does that work? If I have a communication satellite, I can't reconfigure that one to an Earth observation satellite. So how on the software side can that work?
So also, I have to be honest that software defined, people have completely different terminology what they understand by software defined as a platform. And I can share what we understand from what we put in this terminology, because maybe it's not accurate in general terms of the industry. But we wanted our satellite to be able to give you on demand any type of power, communication and processing on demand, and to service different payloads with completely different demand of power, communication and processing in the same time, in the same flight. So this would enable, for example, for you to fly actually an IoT payload and a camera, and them to operate simultaneously sometimes, and serving the needs of our customers, which are the owners, by the way, of the data that those sensors generate. And the whole concept that we have is that the customer really doesn't care who is operating the satellite, where is the ground station. He has a minimalist interface in the cloud through which he controls his camera. Technically, he's an operator of a sensor in space, not an operator of a satellite in space. And I think this is the approach that we want to push even further. We envision very soon that a few of our customers would use applications in orbit. One example is that could be to eliminate junk data before you transfer data to the ground, because of course in low Earth orbit you are much more confined as to the total amount of data that you can transmit from the ground, simply from the fact that you are orbiting the planet 16 times per day usually, and you are very rarely on top of the antenna to transfer the information. So if you can actually transfer information instead of junk data using applications and onboard processing to eliminate the necessary stacks of data, this is, I think, huge improvement for remote sensing and observation as one concrete example.
Okay. Where do you want to be with the company in 5 years from now?
It's a difficult question because the company is 6 years old, so I feel already 60 years old running the company for 6 years, so I don't know where our lives will take us. But
with 110 in that case.
No, but in a few years, I don't know how many years, but in a few years, I really imagine that ideally we would see hundreds of sensors being operated in space as part of a common infrastructure, and all this data would be shared on a universal cloud space. And I think this would really open the argument that we want to break with everything that we do, again, the barrier between space and non-space in a conceptual level. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of smart people in our life, incredibly smart and much more interesting people than myself, for example, they have this mental barrier. When you tell them, well, we are building spacecraft, and always the comment is, oh, you guys are beyond reach, and I don't know what the hell you're doing, and it's so complex. And that's maybe reality because it's a deep tech sector and it's very complex from one side. But from the other side, if you can actually turn the complex, this complex space industry into a streamlined data service accessible in the traditional way, and people are quite used already with the marketplaces and with the platforms and with mobile applications, visualizing the information. So our dream is to see hundreds of different sensors flying with minimum amount of satellites in orbit. So what is meaningful is the visualized information that actually impacts some and extracting maximum efficiency per flight. And we would ideally would like to convince many more customers to join the service. I'm proud to say that just announcing the service a few months ago, we oversold the next two missions completely. And those are pilot missions for us. So this says a lot about that. Also, the market seems to be not so skeptical as we expected towards this new idea.
I think the last mission you launched was with the guys in Kuwait, the QMR-1.
QMR-1
satellite that was built and by you and operated by Bassam and his team.
Yes.
Okay.
We are really proud to and fortunate to work with Bassam and his team, and we are really proud to deliver this first nanosatellite for this first CubeSat for Kuwait. And this also shows that our perception is we don't have this schizophrenic idea. We just have to charge the customer, and for us the most important is just to sign the deal with the customer. Mm-hmm. For us, what matters is for our customers hopefully to be as successful as possible in orbit. And seeing how much their team grew and in capability and knowledge, and now they are operating their own satellite, makes us even more prouder, because they were with us during the whole process of us designing and testing the systems and showing them our approach towards spacecraft engineering and operations. And now I'm excited to see the next few years how they're going to impact even further their region, because interestingly enough, this satellite is also completely open to radio amateur frequencies. And very soon it will be opening to students around the planet to actually file codes and send them to space, run codes directly in orbit. And I think this would be a good chance for many students in the region to really have hands-on experience with the space hardware in orbit.
How to hack your satellite. Cool idea. So why don't we open our discussion a bit wider? Space debris, space situational awareness, space traffic management are more than buzzwords these days. So even the G7 countries, when they're meeting in England a few weeks back, recognize the role of space and the role of space sustainability for all of us. You're building small sats now, nanosats. How does that fit into the space sustainability context?
First of all, my humble opinion is that I don't believe that administrations would ever solve anything for us. I believe in the ingenuity of people like here in the auditorium and innovators and entrepreneurs to solve the issues. And I think the only thing that the administration should do is not to keep filing more and more complex regulations that actually doesn't work at all or are not enforceable in some cases, especially in the space world. But the creation of a culture of self-conscious and understanding about the importance of us being responsible when we operate in space. In terms of our approach, I believe nothing speaks more about our intentions in the fact that instead of trying to sell as much satellites as possible, we try to convince customers to join forces and to use least amount of satellites to fly their missions first. And we try to create this notion that sharing satellite is not a bad idea. This does not make you non-owner of your data or non-owner of your sensor. I think the market would take time to reflect on it, but it's inevitable that things would happen in the shared economy, because that's, I believe, the future in any case of economy. And in terms of sustainability, we build satellites as big as the shoeboxes. They fly quite low Earth orbits, and after the end of their missions, they burn up into the atmosphere due to their small size and lower orbits that they fly, and the minimum amount of satellites that we ideally would like to put in orbit. I think this is our approach to sustainable space. Moreover, we are working on a way that the satellites at certain point would be able to be used as a single integrated infrastructure, which will be much more empowering for our customers flying singular sensors on top of one of those satellites, but those will be acting as a unified constellation in orbit, and I think as a single mind type of flying server in space, technically.
And swarm and intelligence.
Okay. I wouldn't call it intelligence, because it's again a buzzword, and it's not going sensors to take over the planet, and it's not going to pollute.
Okay.
As far as I know, no.
Okay. How do you deorbit your satellites, actively or So do you have some propulsion on it?
With all the commercial missions, we have propulsion. Okay. So ideally, at the end of the journey to of the satellite, they're going to the orbit and burn up into the atmosphere in the most controllable possible way. But also, there are different techniques that you can use in low Earth orbits, such as the way that you position the satellites in the specific orbits. You can make the total surface area that the satellites shows in the direction of the orbits could lead to its decaying orbit faster or slower. So there are also those type of techniques that we use.
Okay. I would like to speak finally about the education, space education, and the pool of talents we have here in the room. So tell us more about the Space Challengers in its 11th edition already.
This year is completely different because we are trying to do it like a bootcamp. What Space Challenges first, maybe? It's a very practice-oriented space education where we believe if you close in one room, if you connect smart young people with experts from the field of space, they could learn pretty fast how they could adapt their current knowledge, whether it's physics, mathematics, engineering or business, into the reality of the space sector. Because fundamentally, science doesn't change with the change of environment. As far as I know, physics remains the same and the fundamental laws of physics are the same in space. But you still need to understand the specificity of that environment so that you can apply your skills. And this was the whole concept from day one with Endurosat and with Space Challenges. Mm-hmm. And during the year, we were really fortunate because we met a huge amount of colleagues that afterwards joined Endurosat after the program. A huge amount of people who started their own companies, people who went to leading universities around the planet to study space science, technology, engineering. And this year, we decided to do something even further because 80% of the time in space challenges is practice oriented. So we really believe that you should get your hands dirty and your mind boggled with a huge amount of challenges to overcome instead of just listening lectures. So the lecturers that are coming are kind enough to share their expertise, to show again where are we right now to nowadays with in the world of space. But from the other side, we really want to see their painful efforts to work in teams, to create the product, to learn how you design a real prototype, functioning prototype of technology. To give you an example, one of the teams this year, we hope that will create a real ground station and actually connect with one of our satellites in orbit and get telemetry out of it. The other team is working on a prototype of a nanosatellite. So I think for 1 month, it's quite dynamic and we are eager to see what happens when you actually make so the students don't go home. They don't get distracted. There is a very little amount of connectivity in the mountain where we are right now. And I thought it's the perfect occasion to do this test bed scenario where I wonder what happens when you close smart young people for 1 month and you ask them to work really hard. And probably, ideally, they're not going to kill each other in the process, ideally, but we never know. But I'm eager to see what the results will be in 3 weeks from now.
Yeah, but I heard you have a number of bears here. They can do the job as well. So,
yeah.
However, who can participate in this program?
The students are usually between 18 and 25 years old, but in many cases we do exceptions and we take people who are younger, up to 16 years old, with permission of their parents, of course. And it's actually very funny because at the beginning everyone is enthusiastic, then you see the stress starting to accumulate as you grow to understand that actually the challenge that you are facing is not insignificant. The dynamics of the program is very hard, so we really try to push them to the limit. But at the end, the results are usually staggering, and I'm eager to see what happens because this year, technically, people will be living, breathing, and thinking about space for one entire month and doing nothing else, hopefully. So we'll see whether this is if this works well, next year we'll probably double the efforts in the same format.
What will happen after this course is finished? They had a great time. They achieved results, not eaten by bears. So they survived. So cool thing. The world is theirs.
First, if you survive space challenges, we always tell it sincerely. It's an achievement for personality and skills on a personal level, I believe. Secondly, I really hope that we all go home healthy nevertheless. And thirdly, it's up to them to decide where and what they want to do with their lives. But hopefully, since they're here and probably enthusiastic about space a little bit more than traditionally, people that you meet on the street, I would suspect that in 4 or 5 years someone would call me and say, Raicho, we have a very strong competitor and it's kicking our ass on the market, and that these guys are incredibly well engineering group and business savvy technical leaders. And if I see some of them to be from space challenges, I did my fair share of adding good value in the process.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. For me, that were two amazing days with amazing people here with all of you. Thanks, Raicho, for being my guest in the Space Cafe Radio on tour. And thank you guys for listening to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What an exciting talk. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for our next Space Cafe Radio episode. In the meantime, visit our website, our mothership, at spacewatch.global. And of course, don't forget to become a Space Watcher. I'm Thorsten Greening, CEO and publisher of spacewatch.global, your independent perspective of space.